Learn how to achieve product market fit with Dan Olson.
All right. So, yeah, I'm here. It sounds like we have a whole product day today. This is awesome. I didn't realize I was part of a whole day. So I'm going to be sharing some advice from my book, A Lean Product Playbook. Real quick about my background so you guys know where I'm coming from. I started out with an engineering background, and then I moved out to Silicon Valley 20 years ago to go to business school at Stanford, and I've been out here ever since. And shortly after getting into product management right after business school, I realized how important UX design was. So I went out of my way to learn UX design. And then 2005, after doing my third web product, I was like, okay, I'm going to be working on the web for a while. I know how to code. I still know how to code these web languages. So I went and studied how to code web language. So I'm primarily a product manager, but I also have learned a lot about UX design and coding as well. I actually started out my career with super, super high-tech products, actually managing nuclear submarine design for the Navy. And then after business school, I asked everybody, hey, where's the best place to learn product management? And everyone said Intuit. So I went to Intuit, and it was. I spent 5 years there, and it was a great place to work. And then since then, I've pretty much been at startups for the most part. I started my own startup, which is called Your Version. I was a personalized news reader that we launched at TechCrunch, and we won the People's Choice Award, so I got to go on stage. That was a lot of fun. And what I do these days, and I've been doing for 8 years, is actually consulting to companies, both startups and established companies, in product management to help them basically create successful products by applying best practices in product management and also lean startup concepts. I guess almost 3 years ago, I started a meetup down in Palo Alto to bring in like the world's top product management, UX design, growth hacker, marketer, speakers. It's called Lean Product Meetup. I'll tell you more about that. My Twitter handle is at Dan Olson. So that's about me. I'd love to hear about you guys. The main thing I'd love to know is what's your job function? Which one do you primarily relate to? So if you could just raise your hands for each one of these. Who's an entrepreneur in the room? All right, we have a few entrepreneurs. Great. Product management. All right. Design. Development. The designers are all well-dressed. They're all looking stylish. I like that. Development. All right, cool. Marketing. And other. If we missed you. You guys are special too. All right, cool. So, you know, I've been product manager for a long time. And one of the great things that happened to product management was actually Lean Startup, because Lean Startup took a lot of concepts that were already there for product management and made them more popular and added additional concepts. And I've been giving this talk, Lego guy here, Lego Ninja, was the talk that I've been given for a long time, how to be a Lean Product Ninja. It's actually what led to the book, the Lean Product Playbook, because somebody saw my talk and said, hey, do you want to write a book? And I used to ask, who's heard about Lean Startup? Nowadays, I ask, who hasn't heard about Lean Startup? And people are embarrassed to put their hands up. So pretty much everyone's heard about it. And if I had to summarize what are the key points of Lean Startup on a slide, it would be these. It's about getting explicit. You know, whenever we're doing product, we're constantly making assumptions and hypotheses, whether we realize it or not. And so Lean Startup is all about getting explicit and articulating those and writing them down so that you can try to test them out. Second point is figuring out the fastest ways, cheapest ways to test those hypotheses so you can basically figure out if you're on the right path. Deliberately keeping your scope small. Like, we don't want to go and spend a lot of time and effort building a product and then realize nobody wants what we just built. That's where the concept of minimum viable product, or MVP, comes in, which we'll be talking about. And then we want to get out of the building and actually test with customers to get their feedback with the goal of learning and iterating, hopefully quickly, with the ultimate goal of achieving higher and higher levels of product market fit. So as I read that off, I see people kind of nodding along. Sounds pretty easy, right? Sounds easy to do, right? Well, the closest analogy I can think of is there are a lot of people I talk to that have read Lean Startup books and they're excited about, they understand these points, but they run into challenges when they try to apply them. The closest analogy I can think of is when January 1st rolls around, you decide, you know what, I'm going to get in better shape. I'm going to work out. I know I need to work out. And you go and you buy a bunch of new workout clothes and you join a gym and you show up at the gym and you have no idea what to do. You're like, this guy maybe. Like, I don't always go to the gym. When I do, I have no idea what I'm doing. Right? It's not for lack of motivation. You're incredibly motivated. It's January 1st. It's the new you. You're going to work out. It's not because you don't know at a high level you need to exercise and work out. You know that, right? What you don't know is the detailed tactics of what you should be doing. It's the exact same situation with Lean Startup. There are plenty of people that get it at a high level and are excited, but then they run into challenges. Or maybe you're like this guy and his buddy kind of winging it. That looks pretty dangerous. Or maybe you're like this person just feeling overwhelmed when you go to actually try to apply these concepts. So that's why I wrote the book. That's why it's actually called the playbook. It's a how-to guide. One of my favorite reviews of the book is a tweet that somebody wrote that said, in the Lean Startup, Eric Ries explains what it is and why it's important. In the Lean Product Playbook, Dan explains how to do it. So this is really how to do it. You'll see the six-step process I'm going to walk you through. One of the top concepts in Lean Startup is product market fit. And this term actually has been around for a while. Mark Andreessen coined it a long time ago in a blog post. But it's a great term because it encapsulates kind of what we're trying to accomplish when we're working on a new product. But there aren't that many great definitions out there. If you Google it, the way people talk about it online is they'll be like, oh, Box succeeded because they have product market fit. Startup X failed because they did not have product market fit. So they kind of talk about it like this truth or false condition of a product, but they don't really give you a model for what it is or how to achieve it. And that's really what I address in my book. After working on so many products with so many teams, I realized there's like a common pattern, and I developed this framework that I call the product market fit pyramid. And it's a 5-part framework. At the bottom, the two layers of the pyramid are the market, basically. We have the target customer, like who are we trying to create value for, whose life are we trying to make better, and what are their underserved needs, right? We'll talk about what underserved means a lot more, but we don't want to address needs that are already being served adequately. And this is a hierarchical model so that basically each layer depends on the layer beneath it. So when we say whose needs are we talking about, the target customer that we just specified, basically. And this is basically, if you take a step back, the definition of a market. If you go to economics or marketing books, they'll say, hey, a market is a set of people that share a common need. That's what a market is. Now, your product, I like to describe with these three layers, your value proposition. And this hopefully connects well with this layer, which is basically, okay, which needs are we actually going to try to address with our product? And how are we going to do so in a way that's better or different than the competition? The feature set, and this is where MVP comes in, which is what's that functionality that we're going to build that's actually going to deliver those benefits to the user, and we don't want to overbuild here before we realize we're going in the wrong direction. So that's, again, where MVP comes in. And then finally, UX, right? Feature set is just words on paper until we actually create a user experience. So the UX design is what brings the functionality to life for users. So that's the product market fit pyramid. When you have this model, it's a way to kind of categorize the key assumptions and hypotheses you need to make that need to hold true to achieve product market fit. Product market fit is just how well are the decisions and assumptions that you're making appear with your product? How well do they resonate with the market? That's basically the product market fit pyramid. Now, once I had this, I realized I could create a process to guide people through formulating and assessing their hypotheses. And so the process just starts at the bottom of the pyramid and works its way up. So we start out with step one, figuring out who our target customer is. Step two, identifying what their underserved needs are. Step three, figuring out which of those needs are we going to address? How are we going to do so in a way that's better? What's the MVP feature set? What's the UX design? Now, once we have a UX design, we have to do a UX design anyway to know what to code and what to tell the developers to build. We need to do it to work through the product definition, but we also can use it as a resource to go and test with customers. So I'm a big proponent, before you code or build, actually testing with customers. At the end, I'll share a case study where I basically did this, and there are multiple examples of doing this. So step six is actually going out and testing with customers where you close the loop, and you basically that's how you assess where you're at with product market fit. So this is the process I'm going to walk you through. And this is an iterative process. So you may have heard of the build, measure, learn loop. This is my modified version that I prefer that starts with hypothesize, because I don't think it should start with build. I think it starts with hypothesizing. You form your hypothesis. You figure out a way to test your hypothesis. Then you test it, and then you learn. And then based on your learnings, you revise your hypotheses and you iterate, right? So this is an iterative process. And it starts with step one. This is the process, determining your target customer. And I should say this technique applies for when you're working on a brand new product, like a V1 product, or you're working on a new feature for an existing product, or like a V2, or a product where you just haven't even applied any of these techniques yet. But say we're doing a new V1 product, and we have to start with who's our target customer. I understand how that can be like a scary, anxiety, kind of anxious kind of thing, because you don't really know who it is yet. And so I just want to acknowledge it's okay. This is the first step. We're starting with a blank slate. It's okay to have a tentative high-level hypothesis because this step one is so closely related to step two. We're going to be going back and forth as we're doing customer discovery interviews and getting clarity on what the customer needs are. We'll be refining who our target customer is. But target customer is very important, and a lot of people skip this step. I want to show you why it's important, because it's not enough just to talk about a high-level customer need. Let's talk about a need that a lot of us have, the need for transportation within 100 miles of your home to get to work, to get to school, to get to the store, get to the hospital, whatever it is. That's a need that a lot of us have. And if we just stay at that superficial level, we're not really going to get the insight we need to make any particular user happy. So the second we start talking about particular users and target customers, we see that even though they share that high-level need, the details change. So let's take, for example, on the one hand, soccer moms, and on the other hand, speed demons. They both have this high-level need to get around, right? As everybody does, as a lot of people do. But if we went and talked to 20 soccer moms and interviewed them, say, hey, tell me what's important to you when your transportation needs, what's important to you? We might find things like, well, I'm carrying my kids and all their gear around, so I need to make sure the car's big enough to hold all that. Driving my kids around, so safety is very important to me. I'm doing a lot of driving, so fuel economy is very important to me. And if, on the other hand, we interview 20 speed demons, they probably wouldn't bring up any of those things. They probably would bring up things like, well, I care about how fast does the car go, how cool does it look, and how cool does it make me look when I'm driving around in it. And you end up with very different products as a result for those different customers, even though, again, they share the same high-level need. And I love talking about the car market, because just think of all the different shapes and sizes of cars that are out there. They've done a good job of optimizing their product for the particular target market and their needs. Great. So once we've gotten a tentative hypothesis, and by the way, personas are used in design typically, but I think you can use them even up at this point in the process, earlier, just a way to catalog your assumptions about your key target customers, basically. Okay. The next step is we want to have a hypothesis about what are the underserved customer needs that we can address for that target customer. And this is where the concept of problem space versus solution space is really important. And I want to explain what it is. So problem space is basically a customer problem, a need, or a benefit, or a well-written requirement. If I said, hey, I want to create a way for us to easily share photos with our friends, that statement, easily share photos with your friends, is in the problem space, right? In contrast, solution space is a specific implementation or a design intended to address that requirement. So if instead I said, hey, I just coded this app that makes it easy to share photos with your friends, that would be in the solution space. That app is in the solution space. If I sketched out some designs for what the app would look like, that would be in the solution space. But again, in contrast, just talking about the need that you want to address, you're staying in the problem space. And the reason this is important is too many product teams jump right into solution space and start designing or coding before they even think about who's this for, what's it supposed to do for them, you know, those kind of things. How's it really going to create value for them? How's it going to be better or different? And the example that I like to use to illustrate some of these concepts is when NASA was sending astronauts into space, they knew that like the pens that we use here that rely on gravity wouldn't work in space because there's no gravity up there. And it wasn't NASA. There's actually, like, if you Google it, you'll end up with some Snopes site that says all urban legend. It wasn't NASA that spent it. But Fisher, this Fisher company, basically the head of that company said, I think I can invent a pen that'll work in space. And he went out and he spent $1 million of his money, not NASA's, and he invented a space pen. Faced with the same challenge, the Russians gave their astronauts pencils. And you can actually get a Russian space pen. It's a cheeky joke. It's a pencil in a red box, basically, right? Now, why do I share the story? I share the story because, one, if these were equally good ways to get the problem solved in space, then obviously the one that didn't take $1 million of R&D and all that time is a higher ROI solution. That's the first reason that I kind of show this example. The second is, far too often, companies and teams, they write their requirements in a way that actually has solution space pollution in it. Right. If I say I need a pen that writes in space, what's the solution space pollution I've got in my requirement? Pen, right? Yeah, pen. Pen is a solution. It'd be better to say I need a way to write in space. That would be a little more abstract, right? And in Lean Startup and the Toyota production system, there's this technique called the five whys, where you kind of try to get at the underlying reasons. You go, why is that? Why, why? Well, it's like, why do we need a way to write in space? Well, we need a way to take notes and refer to them later. That's an even better way to get at the core requirement of what we're trying to do. So as product people, we don't want to say, hey, we need a pen that writes in space or a way that writes in space. We want to be, you know, get at the core needs. And this happens all the time. Teams will talk in solution speak. Oh, we need a feature that does this. We need a widget that does this. We need a configurator. We need a dropdown. We need whatever. That's all solution space, right? And you want to get clear on the problem space first. Now, at the end of the day, there's another requirement that we didn't cover, which is we don't want things to burn in a cabin. So at the end of the day, everyone uses these and they're better than these because this can burn. But I show that example just to kind of bring those points home. Now let's talk about a more relevant software example. As I mentioned, I worked at Intuit on Quicken. Another one of our big products is TurboTax. So what we can do is, it's in the solution space because it's a specific product, right? It's meant to address people's needs. It competes with another specific product, TaxCut. And what you can do is map back and forth. Now, for those of you that use TurboTax, what would you say is like the overall benefit? What's the overall value that it gives you? Electronic filing, okay? Calculates things for you. So that's basically, like, that's the funny thing. This is part of the reason people skip the solution space, because it's hard and it's messy, right? If I talk to five different people, I get five completely different answers. How do I sort that out to figure out what the heck the problem space is supposed to be? So it's messy. But basically, if I had to pick some overall umbrella benefit, it would be something like helps me prepare my taxes or helps me do my taxes. But you can see that it's messy because people use different words. And another person that helped me kind of highlight this concept was Scott Cook. He was the founder of Intuit. And one of the tricks he loved to play on product managers, if he had a group of product managers like this giving a talk, he'd say, who's the biggest competitor to TurboTax? And everyone would raise their hand and he'd pick somebody And then he'd go, tax cut. He's like, no, you're wrong. It's pen and paper, because more Americans are doing their taxes with pen and paper back then, right? So that's the other thing about the problem space. Those markets, they don't move or change anywhere near as quickly as the technology solutions that come and go. And in the book, I talk about like listening to music on the go. You had FM radios, and then you had Walkman, and then you had MP3 players, and you had the iPad. So, but the whole need to listen to music on the go hasn't changed that whole time. Now, once you have a product, what you want to do, say we were building a new tax product, with your team, what you want to do is kind of do divergent thinking. Instead of trying to come up with the answer, think about what are all the different benefits that we could deliver for customers, right? So let's brainstorm some of those. It can check someone to do the calculations. It can check your taxes, right? Maybe you're not that good at math. Computers are great at math. It can file your taxes. Instead of having to go print it out, stand in line at the post office and mail it, it can save you time by electronic filing. It can help you save money by maximizing your deductions. It can ask you some questions and find some things you may not have known that you can write off. It can analyze your return and reduce your audit risk. These are just examples. And what you want to do is basically, as a team, brainstorm what are all those different things that we can address for people. The other thing I would say is you can tell a well-written, if you look at these closely, you'll see they're written in a certain way. They all start with an action verb. It's like a verb. Because if something's delivering value for users, it's probably going to be doing something. It's going to have a verb. It's also written from the customer's perspective. My, right? There are implicit my's here. I just didn't put them in there because the ovals are too small, right? But that's the idea of problem space, right? It's like verb, my, something like just, it's not build a configurator that does X, Y, Z. It's basically written from the customer's perspective. And again, you want to peel the onion and generate as many ideas as you can. Now, when you do this, we saw how it was kind of messy with people saying different things, right? But you'll find that there are related benefits and some kind of order in the chaos. So let's take these three benefits, for example. Help me prepare my taxes, reduce my audit risk, check my return. If we did the five whys like I did with this gentleman and said, why is that valuable? Why is that valuable? Why is it valuable? People may start out with something very specific. And if you saw this in the answers, some people were very specific. Someone said like animations, right? So the animations is super specific. And then if you said why, you're kind of climbing up this ladder to get at what's the high level thing they're talking about. We call that benefit ladders. If I did the five whys on these, I would probably end up with statements about, well, I'm not good at math. I don't know the tax laws. And so every time I do my taxes, I'm scared because I don't know what I'm doing. I feel intimidated. I'm probably going to mess it up. Maybe I'm going to get fined or put in jail. I don't know. But with TurboTax, now it walks me through and just it guides me through everything. I don't need to know the taxes, right? That would be an empowerment or confidence benefit. There could be a whole separate ladder. We eventually got to save time, right? Saves time preparing taxes. And this is, for example, save time. If you took a stopwatch and you timed the old way, how much time did it take? And you took a stopwatch and you timed the new way, you could quantify that time savings, whether it's preparing taxes or filing taxes. If we did five whys on that, we end up with save time. That's a completely separate benefit ladder from empowerment or confidence. And there's a third ladder, save money, right? Maximize my tax section. It has nothing to do with those two. And so if we rotate this 90 degrees, it looks like an org chart. Now what you're doing is you're kind of creating some order out of that problem space definition. That's what you want to do as a team. This is a miniature version of it. But as a team, you want to brainstorm all these ideas and start to cluster them and organize them so you can form those hypotheses. You'll notice this whole time that I'm talking about TurboTax and kind of create order out of the problem space, I haven't mentioned the features at all, right? It turns out that they have features. They have a feature for each one of these. And if you have a well-named feature that maps directly to a customer problem, a well-articulated customer problem, then you get a benefit where just by reading the name of the feature, you can pretty much tell how it's going to be valuable to you, right? Now, if you follow my advice and you come up with like dozens of potential benefits that you could address, the next question is, okay, we can't possibly do all these or focus on all these, so which ones do we actually do? So you need to prioritize somehow. And I think the best way to prioritize is based on customer value. That begs the question, how do we determine customer value? So when I was at Intuit and had to wrestle with this question, I created a framework called importance versus satisfaction that I want to share with you guys as a way to prioritize which ones we're actually going to go after. Importance is on the vertical axis. It goes from low to high on how important is user need. Like I could ask Jerry, hey, Jerry, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is it to save money? Okay. How important is it to experience local culture? And if I ask Billy, he's have different answers. That's the idea. And you can think of it two ways. One is like some survey that we survey thousands of people and we ask them number 1 to 10, and it's very quantitative. But the other way is just as a thinking tool for you and your team, just low, medium, high, like how you said high, low, medium, high. Now, satisfaction, and that's the problem space. Satisfaction is how satisfied are people with how they're getting those needs met today, right? So when you travel, as far as experience, looking, culture, how satisfied are you with what you're doing today with hotels or whatever, right? And again, we can go low to high. And to talk about this, to break it down, let's just divide it into the four quadrants, okay? In the bottom left quadrant, we have a low importance user need, and we have low satisfaction with customer with current alternatives. And down here, we have low importance user need and high satisfaction with current alternatives. At the end of the day, none of these, neither of them are really worth going after because you're addressing a low importance need. Like if you're going to go build a business or spend all this time and money, you wouldn't do this. Nobody really does this on purpose. No one says, hey, let's go address this low important need. What happens is they think it's an important need. They don't do these techniques that we're talking about to validate it with customers. They launch it and they realize, oh, geez, nobody thought it was important. Now, in the upper right, we have high importance of user needs, so that's definitely better than low importance, right? But we also have a high satisfaction with the current alternatives. People are pretty happy with what's out there, even though it's a high importance need. That's basically a competitive market. And one of the things I think of there is like Google search. It's not like people walk around going, gosh, man, I can't find anything on Google search. It just doesn't work, you know? Like if you type it in, you pretty much end up finding what you need for the most part, right? So it's pretty much. And here people say you need to be 10x better. This is where you need to be 10x better. You can't just come out with a Me Too product or 1%, 2% better product. People aren't going to switch. So I'm not saying you can't go after a competitive market. You can, but you have to get really clear on your value proposition and how you're going to be like 10x better. The final quadrant is here in the upper left is high importance of user need and low satisfaction with what's out there today. This is where there's opportunity, right? Because you've got something that's important to people, but they're not satisfied with what's out there today. And these do exist. They don't exist forever. We live in a capitalistic society with a lot of other entrepreneurs seeing opportunities and trying to address them. But they can exist for a while. The example I like to list here is Uber. Uber's done a lot of things right that don't have anything to do with this framework, right? They've done a good job on their product, on scaling up their operations, on marketing to drivers and riders, and rolling out globally. They've done a lot of great things. But I think an unspoken reason why they're so successful is that they fundamentally address an upper left quadrant need. You don't even have to do it, but imagine we asked, especially here in the city, I used to take taxi cabs in the city. If you asked, took 50 people that used to take taxi cabs before they took Ubers and said, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is it to get to your flight at SFO on time? Pretty important. How important is it to get to that job interview on time? Pretty important to get to that business meeting, that date, whatever it is. It's pretty important to get where you need to be going on time, high importance. And in contrast, we said, hey, how satisfied, think about the last 5 cab rides you went on. How satisfied were you overall on a scale of 1 to 10, right? And we can start breaking it down. Did the person show up on time? How satisfied were you with their punctuality? How satisfied did they show up at all? How safe did you feel? How clean was the car? You know, how safe did you feel when you were driving? How easy was it to pay the person? Things like that. Not every taxi ride, obviously, but a lot of them you can imagine low satisfaction, right? That's what we're talking about in that upper left quadrant. And what I like about this framework is it's a visual framework. So what I'm trying to say is if there's a product that's this red dot that addresses a certain need that has that level of importance and it provides this level of satisfaction in how it addresses that need, then that rectangle, the area created by that rectangle, is a proxy for how much customer value it creates. And if there's another product that addresses a higher importance need with a higher level of satisfaction, then its rectangle is that much more bigger because it creates that much more customer value. And when you see it this way, you realize that the area to the right of where you are today with where people are with their current products, that's the opportunity, right? However much room there is to the right, that's an opportunity to create additional customer value beyond what's out there today. And that's why that upper left quadrant offers the biggest opportunities. And if you have an existing product, you can create value by just increasing the level of satisfaction with which you address that user need. Now, if this seems kind of conceptual or theoretical, let me show you some real data. Okay, so you know I mentioned how you can use the thinking tool with your team, low, medium, high, keeping it rough. You can also do it explicitly and quantitatively. And this is what we did at one of my products. We had 13 key features in our products, and we surveyed thousands of users and asked them to rate the importance and satisfaction. And so each of these dots, these 13 points, is one of those features plotted with its corresponding importance and satisfaction. The number next to it is the satisfaction number. You can see now it goes from 0 to 100. So the first thing that I saw as a product manager was this feature up here. People were saying it's 100% importance, 98% satisfaction. I was like, awesome, great job, guys. My second thought was, we don't need to spend any of our valuable engineering resources working on that thing anymore. That one's pretty much set. Let's go find other things that are going to create more value. And we have a cluster of features here. And we have this one way down there. But this guy over here, this feature, it's relatively high importance and low satisfaction. It's the one in the most upper left. It offered the biggest opportunity. So we prioritized that the highest. And I was excited that after I was into it, I realized there are other people that also had kind of independently created importance versus satisfaction frameworks. One of them is Anthony Ulwick. He has a book called What Customers Want that I recommend. He actually just came out with a new book, Jobs to Be Done. You know, Jobs to Be Done has been a popular framework, but there hasn't really been a good book on it. He just came out with that book. I mentioned I run a meetup. He's actually speaking at my meetup in Palo Alto April 4th, so I'm super excited to have him come talk then. Okay, let's move on, guys. So, you know, we brainstormed the customer needs that we could address. We've run it through this importance and satisfaction filter to figure out which of the ones that are probably going to create the most value. The next thing we want to do is really get clear and commit to which ones are we going to actually tackle with our product and how are we going to be better than the competition. And I actually studied lean manufacturing before I came to Silicon Valley at night from Virginia Tech. And I learned about the Kano model there, which is a cool model that you can really apply in product. And it's a great way to frame how we talk about a value proposition. So let me explain the Kano model. It also talks about user satisfaction going from completely dissatisfied to completely satisfied. And then on the horizontal axis, we're trying to basically represent how fully does the product meet the need, from not met at all to fully met, right? So that's the XY here. And the cool thing about the Kanos, may sound kind of complicated, is it breaks everything down into one to three categories of customer need or feature. The first is a performance benefit or feature. This is easy to understand. More is better, less is worse. The more you have of this, the more customer value is created. If we were developing microprocessors for computers, the faster the chip speed, the more value it creates, right? That all other things being equal. I like to use cars to illustrate these things. So say we were shopping for a car. There were two cars, and they looked pretty similar, and the specs look pretty similar. But then all of a sudden, we realized car A has twice the miles per gallon as car B. We would pick car A because fuel efficiency is basically a performance benefit for cars. The second category is must-haves. So having a must-have doesn't actually make anybody happy, but not having the must-have makes people unhappy. Right? Sticking with cars, say I was on the showroom and it was this wonderful car. I loved the way it looked. And I read the little spec sheet on the window and all the specs looked great. But then I took a peek inside and I noticed it didn't have any seatbelts. I wouldn't buy that because seatbelts are a must-have for a car. But if car A has 5 seatbelts and car B has 100 seatbelts, I wouldn't say car B is 20 times better than car A, right? Because once you have one seatbelt per person, you're checked off, you're good to go, right? And then the third category is delighters. So not having a delighter doesn't cause any problems because people aren't expecting it to be there, but having a delighter can create a lot of customer satisfaction. Sticking with cars, not today, but when the first cars came out with GPS navigation, it was a delighter because before that, people were getting lost or printing out Google Maps or asking for directions. And with GPS, they would just put in their address and they'd get from point A to point B with no problem or no hassle. But as we know, over time, more and more cars have GPS. TomToms and Garmins came out, and now we all just, you know, use GPS on our phones. So that illustrates that basically this isn't a static picture. Needs and features migrate over time so that yesterday's delighters become today's performance features, become tomorrow's must-haves. And the pace with which that happens depends on your space that you're in, innovation and the competition. So what we want to do is use the Kano model to answer the question, okay, which user benefits are we providing, and how are we going to be better than our competitors, right? We don't want to be... You know, there's a number of stories of some entrepreneur going in and pitching to a VC and going, hey, I'm going to build this photo sharing. I have a great idea for a photo sharing app. And they're like, hold on a sec. Have you seen this before? You know, and it's not to say just because someone has already tried to do it or started doing it that you shouldn't go after it. You just got to get really clear how you're going to be better or different. There's a reason Instagram was the winning photo sharing app. It wasn't just blind luck. It was because of things like how quickly did they upload photos, right? Filters as a delighter, things like that. We can break it down with this kind of a model. So what we want to do is for our product category, we want to list one per row, what are all the must-have benefits, what are all the performance benefits, and what are the delighter benefits. And I've kept this abstract. In a second, we're going to do this for Airbnb and make it more concrete and specific. But what you want to do is step one, list those benefits, right? So we would list those 6 benefits, for example. Then you want to list a column for each of your key competitors. And you don't want to have like 10. That's too many to get your head around, right? You just want to limit it to 2 or 3 archetypal competitors. And then you want to have a column for you and your product. And then what you want to do is score or evaluate your competitors on each of these dimensions. Okay, these guys, yeah, they both have must-have benefit 1 because it's a must-have. Competitor A is the best at performance benefit 1. Competitor B is the best at performance benefit 2. They're both so-so at performance benefit 3, and these guys have a delighter. This is the backdrop on which we want to build what our value proposition is, right? This is the essence of product strategy, is figuring out how are we going to be better or different, right? You don't start with your solution first. You have to have intuition and hypotheses of how it can be better, but it needs to be coupled with what's going on in the marketplace, right? What's out there today? And the essence, one of my favorite definitions of strategy, is it means saying no. It means we're not doing something. Because if you just say yes to everything, there are plenty of sales team examples where the sales team goes out and talks to a prospective client. Hey, your product going to have feature A? Oh, yeah, it's going to have feature A. Next day, they talk to another prospective client. It's going to have feature B? Oh, yeah. The salesperson never says no. They say yes to every person because they want to get the sale. That's not strategic. That's like what I call a five-year-old soccer game. They're just all following the ball around wherever it goes. It's not strategic. Right? And the definition of strategic means not easily reversible. Right? If you can just change your mind tomorrow, that wasn't really a strategic decision. So, okay. And along those lines, I have another Steve Jobs quote in the book there, which is a great quote that he said, which is, he said, for every yes, when they make a yes to approve a certain feature or product design decision, there have been 1,000 no's before that. That's kind of the essence of being strategic. So given this backdrop, we go through now and we put up our hypothesis for how we think we're going to create a unique value in the marketplace. Of course, we're going to have the must-have. We're going to deliver a little bit of performance benefit one, but we're not going to try to be the best at that one. We're going to not worry too much about performance benefit two, and we're going to focus on being the best at performance benefit three, right? We're going to be a high there when the other guys are medium. Maybe we've identified a certain segment that really values that benefit. Maybe we have some technology ideas as to how we can provide a higher level of satisfaction than what's already out there. And then we have our own idea for our own delighter, basically. This would be an example. At the end of the day, you're not going to compete on must-haves, right? What you're going to compete on, what your unique, what we call your unique differentiators, what makes your product special and the way it creates value is the performance benefit that you're going to be the best on and any unique delighters that you have. That's really what we want to get to, right? And before you go into that MVP, you want to make sure you're clear on this so you don't just build some random MVP that doesn't have this stuff in it. So the top mistakes I see people make, the whole point of an MVP is to not overbuild before you realize you're going in the wrong direction or confirm you're going in the right direction. That's the whole reason. Even though that's the whole point of an MVP, I still see people overscoping their MVPs. Again, it's just human nature. It's just like, no, hey, Dan, I read your book. I totally understand why I need to descope this, but here's why my MVP needs A, B, C, D, E, and F, right? And then you get in there and you start asking them and you end up realizing that there's 80-20 and you can cut some stuff. So even though that's what it's designed for, I still see people all the time overscoping. And it's a tough call, right? It's a tough call. It's kind of perceived to be less risky. Yeah, you know, they might really need feature F. Let's just put it in there too. I understand the temptation and the desire, but try to resist that. The second one, mistake I see people make, I like to explain with this pyramid. Here's another pyramid. This is based on a framework from Aaron Walter's book, Designing for Emotion. If you haven't read it, recommend it. He was the head of UX design at MailChimp, which if any of you remember when MailChimp first came out, was like this huge breath of fresh air in the email platforms because it was great, easy to use, super simple, funny, you know, it was great. So Jesse Passanen modified his framework and then I modified Jesse, so I just want to give those guys credit. But basically the way to think about a product is like how functional is it, how reliable is it, how usable is it, how delightful is it? And you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a lot of focus on usability, which is great. People now nowadays people know that it needs to be usable. And that answers the question, can people, you know, use your product? I love how there's more and more focus on delight in the last several years. And that's more like, do people want to use your product? How do they feel when they use your product? So we're elevating the discussion to that point. And the idea is start out with this empty pyramid and you color in at that point, whatever version of your product you've got, you color in how functional it is, how reliable, how usable it is, right? That's the idea. And one of the other top mistakes I see people make with an MVP is they do this. So they build a subset of they don't build all the functionality, which is great because that's the whole point of an MVP, is not to build all the functionality, but they use MVP as an excuse to say, ah, it's okay if it's buggy, it's okay if it's not easy to use, it's just an MVP. I hear people use that all the time, right? How well do you think, when you go and test this with customers, how well do you think it does? It doesn't do well because they can't get past the bugs and they can't figure out how to use it. It doesn't matter if you have the world's best travel flight search engine in the world. If people can't find it or figure out how to use it, it doesn't matter if it's buggy. So it's true that you only want to build a portion of the pyramid for your MVP, but the portion you want to build is like this. So you want to build a subset of functionality. And I'm not saying it's going to be completely bug-free and be amazing, you know, pixel-perfect design, but for the part that you bite off, you want to make sure it's reliable enough and usable enough and delightful enough so that you can test your value prop and see if you're going in the right direction. The next step is to create your prototype. You know, I don't have time today to get into this. This is basically where UX design comes in. UX design is super important. You may have a great product idea, but if you fall flat on your UX design, again, people aren't going to be able to see the beauty of how it creates value. I have a whole chapter in the book just focused on UX design. I think it's important for non-designers to know enough about it. And then finally, we get to step six. After doing our UX design, I'm a big advocate of having like clickable or tappable high-fidelity mockups, like in InVision, you know, taking your designer's assets and putting them in InVision and creating a happy path prototype that you can test with people before you build. And so what I want to share is a case study where I applied this lean product process from beginning and end to end to show you that real example. So I was working for a startup that had an existing product, and they had an idea for a new product that was called marketingreport.com. It was a small team. It was me, the CEO, the VP of marketing, and a designer. And the CEO had an idea for a new business opportunity, which I'll explain in a sec, but he had very limited dev resources. So he said, hey, we have to explore this idea and try to validate it without coding at all. And I was very excited because I like doing that. Instead of wasting dev resources, I want to validate things first. So I said, great. And the idea was a marketing report that lets you control the junk mail or direct mail that you get at your house. Does anyone here, everyone get junk mail? Anyone not get junk mail? Right? So big target market for this. But the idea is like, say I come home from work and there's a coupon for cat litter there. Well, why did I get a coupon for cat litter? It's because in some marketing database somewhere in the cloud, it thinks that Dan Olson has a cat, and they're trying to sell me this because they think it's relevant, right? So that was the idea. It was to provide transparency and empower you to fix things related to why you're getting the mail that you're getting. There were a lot of parallels to a credit industry and the credit reports. The CEO had worked in the credit industry before. So if you think about it, you know, years ago, before there was transparency in credit reports and credit scores where you could see, you'd be getting denied or approved for loans and credit cards and not really know why. It's the same idea. Why did you get denied? Because in some database in the cloud, it says, based on your social security number, that you didn't pay your bills or something like that. And by having a credit report, you can see what data they have and fix it if it's wrong. That was the idea of the marketing report, very analogous to a credit report. So the first thing I did is say, great. The target customer, by the way, was a lot of people, everyone that receives junk mail, so a big target market. And the first thing I did is say, great, let's map out the problem space and what our top solution space ideas are. So the core idea was learn why I received the mail I received, basically, right? That was the core ideas, provide that transparency. And that was the core problem. And the core solution set ideas that we, solution space ideas that we had were a marketing report, which was like a credit report, marketing profile that would show the information that they had on you that you could fix, and a marketing score, which is analogous to a credit score. So those are the three main features related to the main benefit. Now, one of the executives, in addition to this, wanted to test out some related ideas of money-saving offers. Hey, maybe I don't have a cat, but maybe I have a dog, and I'd love to raise my hand and say, hey, send me dog food coupons. I'll take those, and that would be valuable to me. He thought he had a hypothesis that maybe people want to compare how their spending patterns and habits, how much they're spending with other people, and how much are they spending on pet food. And then because social networking was hot at the time, social networking got thrown in there too. Pretty much pure solution space. And then the other executive didn't care about these blue items. He cared about, again, this was the primary thing he cared about, but he cared about just reducing junk mail. Can you just reduce the overall junk mail that I get? And we brainstorm a secondary benefit of saving, being green and saving paper and saving trees as a result. So I iterated, you know, I led discussions with these guys and facilitated, iterated to this point. I said, okay, does everyone have all their ideas on this board? They said, yes. I said, great. I looked at this. So this is way too big for one MVP concept. So what I proposed and what we did is let's take this core stuff in the green, let's combine it with this yellow, and let's call that one concept, the marketing shield concept, because it's shielding you from junk mail. And then what we'll do is we'll create a second concept that's got the core green items plus the blue items. And because it's focused on saving you money, we'll call that the marketing saver concept. So we basically developed two sets of prototypes that were kind of similar. And they both shared these benefits and features. But one had those and one had those. Make sense? Here's an example. You know, I don't have time to get into it, but I talk about different levels of fidelity and interactivity. This is probably a medium fidelity. This was the landing page that we did. Nothing too fancy. We didn't obsess about the visual design. And then when you clicked in and got to the main page, we had these little modules, and this is how we would mix and match the two concepts, the saver concept versus the shield concept. And it had a certain number of features. And if you, each one of these, when you clicked on it, would go to a page that was all about that feature. So it was like a mini website of about 9 pages that we were testing. And so I've moderated the testing with target customers, and here's what we learned. Here's that same chart, color-coded now. Green, you know, nothing was a slam dunk. Green meant that there was some appeal there. There were still questions and concerns, but we felt like they were addressable and that if we could address the questions and concern, there's an opportunity to potentially create real customer value on the green. Yellow meant there was some appeal, but it was low. Red meant that people were pretty much not interested in it or confused by it. They just weren't interested in it. So the first observation is, did we get any green? Yes, we did. There's no guarantee when you do this that you'll get green. You could be so far off or just not have a fit that there's no green. So one, we found green, so we were excited about that. Secondly, remember, this was the core idea. Is there any green in the core idea? There's no green on the core idea. So it's like, thank God we tested something else. And this happens all the time, right? Slack didn't start out to be a messaging platform, right? Flickr didn't set out to be the photo platform that they did. So this happens all the time. Is you, by getting out of the building, forming hypotheses, getting a prototype, getting out of the building and talking to people, they're like, well, I don't care too much about that. But let me tell you about this other thing that really bothers me, you know, and you find those adjacent opportunities all the time. The third thing is that we found some red. I was really happy about this red. Not surprisingly, the things that were just kind of artificially bolted on were red, right? But this one I was especially excited about because do you know what a marketing score is? I don't know what a marketing score is. But I do know it would have taken, we didn't have the data to generate it. It would have taken an expensive third-party API data license. It would have taken hiring some really smart engineers to come up with some algorithm and develop that and perfect it. And it would take a lot of money to explain what users what a marketing score is and educate them on that. Guess what? Because it's red, we can cut out all that stuff that's not going to create value. So it's not only about finding green, it's about finding red and not wasting your time on that. So the cool thing is, again, we hadn't coded anything. So I didn't have any qualms about throwing those mockups out and starting from scratch. And what we did, we basically talk about pivoting, right? You need to pivot. A pivot is when you change one of those fundamental assumptions in the product market fit pyramid, who you're going after, which need you're going after, which way you're going to be better or different, right? Which key features in there. That's a pivot. So we started here and we had to decide, we're going to pivot here and do this one, or we're going to pivot here and do this one. And we decided to pivot here because one, it was more consistent with the brand that the company already had. And two, there were already a lot of people doing this, so it was hard to think of how we'd be differentiated over here. And three, this would take a lot of time with biz dev deals and partnerships to get these offers going. It would just take a lot of time and effort. So we decided to pivot here. And so again, we threw everything out. I had about 6 pages worth of notes from the Shield sessions with customers. And I just made sure that in the new set of mockups, every single one was addressed or resolved. And so we pivoted to junk mail freeze. Right? This is the new mockup that we did, completely different. Now, the interesting thing too is, you remember how I said, like, too often teams stay at the superficial outer layer of the onion, like, hey, I need to get around 100 miles from my house. Well, in hindsight, reduced junk mail is pretty much like that high-level thing. And that's the beauty when you go out and talk to customers and you do customer discovery and you get feedback, you learn so much about the problem space. I learned a lot of things. I learned, first off, that not all junk mail is the same. There are certain types of junk mail that really, really annoy and bother people more than others. The ones that really annoy people, we put front and center here, were all the financial-related ones, like cash advance checks, pre-approved credit card offers. And then when I talked to people, I found out why. A lot of them live in houses that don't have locked mailboxes. So they're worried that while they're at work, after the post person drops off their mail, someone's going to reach in there, grab it, take money from their account, or do identity theft or something like that. Right? So there was a big negative emotion associated with this specific types of mail. So we put it front and center. The second time around when we did the research, people were like, they're like looking at this and nodding because they're like, you can see their temples starting to bulge, like they hate that stuff. Other things, we talked about reduced junk mail. When I talked to people in the Shield segment, probably about 70-80% of them told me, tell me what you do when you get home from, you know, when you check your mail. Like, well, let me tell you, 6 days a week, I go to my mailbox, I come back in the house, I go straight to the paper shredder, and I go shred, 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 shred for 5 minutes. 5 minutes a day, 6 days a week, 30 minutes a week, 50 weeks a year, 1,500 minutes a year shredding mail. There was a whole separate save time benefit that we didn't even think about because we didn't know, because we hadn't talked to people. So a whole other save time benefit that we then messaged in the second time around. Other silly things, like we said we're going to save trees. Several people said, well, how many trees are you going to save? So we put in 43 trees right there to answer their questions. And this time around, it was great. It was like a night and day difference, right? This time around, people were just kind of nodding along. And we learned all kinds of details about, like, how would you control the mail that comes through and doesn't. And it's like, okay, you can block my catalogs because they clutter up my mailbox. But my Pottery Barn catalog, that's got to get through. I got to get that one. So all these little UI things about how to control your mail. But it was night and day difference. It was very cool. People, for the most part, there were still a couple of questions here and there, but for the most part, they were just kind of nodding along. And I didn't mention this, but both times we asked people, hey, would you pay 10 bucks a month for this? And it's always iffy to ask people if they would pay. We were just talking about behavioral versus attitudinal. Yeah, I'll pay. Sure, that's attitudinal. Did you actually bust out your wallet and pay? But there was like a night and day difference. The first time around, nobody was having anything to do with paying for this thing. The second time around, what they said is, they said, I need a 30-day free trial, but if your product did what it said, I would gladly pay you guys 10 bucks a month. And beyond that, after the test was done, I was like, thank you so much for your time. Here's your check for 100 bucks for your time. Almost every single person was like, so is this live now? Can I go use this? We're like, no, we're still working on it. And they're like, can I give you my email? Could you email me when it comes out live? Like, nobody did that the first time around. So that was like a non-test test that showed that there was extra interest. So I was pretty psyched about that. So to sum up the lean product process, and I'll start out with getting clear on who your target customer is, identifying their underserved needs, figuring out how you're going to be better or different, what's that minimum viable product feature set so you're not overbuilding before you go down the path to figure out you're on the right path, creating a prototype so that you can work through the design and also so you have something to go out and test with customers, testing to assess where you're at on product market fit, and iterating. So you know, hypothesize, design, test, learn, go through that loop with the goal of improving product market fit. So hopefully you guys can apply that again. It's meant to be a playbook. I mentioned that I run a meetup down in Palo Alto. It's every month. I bring in the top like PM, product management, UX design, growth hacking speakers. We have Amy Jo Kim coming on the 14th. She's going to be talking about her specialty. She used to work on like Rock Band and Sims and things like that, making products very engaging for people. And she's going to bring examples from Snapchat, Slack, and Kickstarter for how you can make your products as deeply engaging as those. That's on the 14th. If you go to meetup.com/lean-product. And thanks a lot for your time, guys.